science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now it's time for Dear Science. We're joined by Sam Fraser-Baxter, a recent graduate of a Masters of Science Communication from the University of Otago. Kia ora, Sam.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Very good. I enjoyed Idiotech.
Yeah, I know. We always get songs programmed into the wire, so we don't get a lot of choice, and I was really stoked about this choice, about this option we had today on the show.
Yeah, that was a good one.
So first off, today we're talking about South Dunedin and how it's New Zealand's first underwater city. This sounds kind of alarming.
Yeah, so it's not yet underwater, but it could be.
Yeah, so what's the sort of timeline for this?
It's pretty hard to say. I mean, all this speculative kind of sea level rise data is hard to deal with, and especially to make it geographical case specific. But if it's anything to go by, the South Dunedin groundwater and flooding situation is quite alarming.
And so why, what's been actually happening? So what have we been seeing? What's the situation down there?
So in June in 2015, South Dunedin experienced a really dramatic flooding event. And basically over a 24-hour period, 175 mils of rainfall. So for Dunedin, that's about the equivalent of two months of rainfall in about one day, and as a result they experienced some really, really dramatic flooding. About 1,250 homes are affected, and following the floods about $30 million in insurance was paid out.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite something. I saw some photos which looked a little bit like Venice.
Yeah, a bit of like an Arctic Venice.
Yeah. And so why has this been happening?
So South Dunedin is a very vulnerable area for flooding, and that's basically to do with its geomorphic history. So the whole area of South Dunedin was once a marshy intertidal estuary, and basically in the 1800s, European settlers embarked on this huge mission of land reclamation. So they basically started taking out sand from the dunes, which would have extended about 100 metres back from St Kilda and St Clair beaches, which is the main kind of town beaches in Dunedin. And they took that sand and basically built up on top of the kind of marshy, low-lying area. And on top of that, they built South Dunedin. So what you've got now is you've got a very, very shallow groundwater. So the groundwater sits about half a metre below the surface in South Dunedin.
So basically South Dunedin is super vulnerable to flooding.
Yeah, really vulnerable, because what happens is when there's a high rainfall event, basically all the rain water percolates into the ground, and the ground between the surface and the groundwater kind of acts as a sponge, and when the ground soaked up too much water, the ground actually floods.
And so this all kind of comes down to global warming, right?
In a way. So over the next few decades or centuries, New Zealand is going to experience higher incidence of cyclonic events and extreme rainfall events. So as a country, we're going to experience lots of these flooding events. So these kind of events in Dunedin are symptomatic of what's to come. And you know, in April with Cyclone Cook, Edgecombe and the Bay of Plenty experienced really dramatic flooding where 1,600 people were displaced. And like South Dunedin, Edgecombe is a low-lying area and it sits on a floodplain. So that was another example of the kind of aftermath of these kind of big rainfall events, which is only going to increase with global warming.
Right, because you can kind of connect global warming directly with these extreme weather events?
Perhaps not in the short term, because when we talk about global warming or climate change, we're talking about kind of long-term patterns. You can't take one storm or one flooding event and say, hey, this is directly related to climate change. But if we're seeing the incidence of those increase over long periods of time, we can then confidently say, yes, those are directly related to anthropogenic induced climate change.
So if they're getting more and more frequent and more extreme, then it's kind of, that's a conclusion you might be able to draw.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, like, it's going to come at a huge cost to the government and to local governments. And, you know, there was $30 million paid out in insurance to South Dunedin. The Edgecombe flooding and the Bay of Plenty would have come at a huge cost. So as a country, it's going to be something that we're going to have to learn to deal with and become resilient to.
Yeah, so my next question is that, are we doing enough currently to preemptively stop future things happening? Or is it kind of seems like from the South Dunedin example, it was kind of like, oh shit, this thing happened. Now we've got to pay all this stuff, pay very expensive costs after the fact. Like, what are we doing now to stop these things happening in the future?
Well, the response to South Dunedin flooding, it reflects a kind of wider global paradigm that seeks to deal with these urban issues, where we're now saying, shit, you know, we've got to reduce our carbon emissions and greenhouse gas emissions, but at the same time, we've also really got to look to find ways to be resilient and to adapt to these extreme weather events. So, in South Dunedin, the council has passed a bylaw saying that all new developments in the area, housing, it has to be built 1 metre above the ground. So if it does flood again, which it will, these houses won't be damaged as severely. They've also been looking at increasing the stormwater system so they can effectively pump out stormwater. But you know, there's no silver bullet, and at the end of the day, these flooding events will continue and only intensify. So, you know, globally, we've got to say, how do we deal with these in the short term? And perhaps more importantly, we've also got to be thinking about, you know, how can we reduce our emissions and try and stop global warming?
Right, because I guess those examples with what's being done just If a case like this happens again in South Dunedin, those examples that you used of what the government has done to stop the harm being so bad, it kind of sounds like those are the short-term things. But what about the long-term things? Are we doing enough long-term planning to be able to stop such terrible things happening as a result of climate change?
On a kind of regional scale or a national scale or a global scale?
I mean, in terms of like the emissions, for example, or other sorts of things to stop these actual events happening in the first place. So like taking that really macro sort of long-term perspective.
Well, you know, in recent decades, we've seen all these kind of political agreements, which have all been voluntary, and kind of year after year, New Zealand isn't quite fulfilling our promises of what we're going to do. So in a way you could say, no, New Zealand isn't doing enough, and no, the world isn't doing enough to combat our greenhouse gases and try and lessen these events, which are really going to hurt us in the long term. So these flooding events, you know, they provide this really dramatic kind of day after tomorrow imagery where, you know, you've seen this whole southern city flooded, and it's symptomatic of what's to come. So in a way, a good wake-up calls for us, where we can go, all right, this is what's going to happen, it's going to be expensive, so maybe we should try and get our act together and do something more meaningful.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess it's hard, though, when there's like these short-term political cycles that perhaps it could be easier for governments to be able to put things on the back burner because they know that, like the worst of it isn't going to happen when they're in government potentially, or those particular leaders are not still leading, that it might be 20 years or 50 years or 100 years from now that that's where we're going to be seeing the worst of it. So it can be easy to push it away in terms of priorities, that a lot of the priorities, I mean, for example, going to this year's election, we've got housing and stuff like that, which is kind of a little bit more short term than climate change.
Yeah, you did right. The political, short political cycles is one problem for politicians to really kind of get their teeth into dealing with global warming. And academics often describe climate change as creeping normality, and that's essentially because the effects of global warming are very gradual, that occur over years, decades and centuries, so really long time frames. So people slowly become normalized to these creeping incremental effects, and because of it, the public's, you know, they don't find it or deal with it as a scary risk. So they're not lobbying, but lots of people aren't lobbying for meaningful political change just because it's kind of in the back of their mind. We're not that exposed to climate change as a kind of visceral or vivid risk. So people are less inclined to say, hey, do something about it when, you know, you can't pay rent or you can't buy a house. So as a society, we've got to find better ways to talk about climate change and deal with these different political issues.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I guess not only that, but also now we're, because climate change is obviously very much a global issue, we're also, so it needs to be this global solution. But then now we suddenly have somebody in office in the US who is a denier of man-made climate change. So like we're up against that as well. So it's just like so many barriers to forging this positive solution, I suppose.
Yes, it's really hard not to get jaded with it all and kind of how inactive the world's been. But there is hope. I read the other day in The Guardian that solar power is slowly undercutting coal as an energy source. So that's exciting too.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for talking with us again, Sam. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show the past couple of weeks. You've been awesome. So I think we'll be back with Alan next week, but thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dear Science.